From WAMU 88.5 at American University in Washington, welcome to the Politics Hour starring Tom Sherwood. I'm Kojo Nandi. Tom Sherwood is our resident analyst and a reporter with NBC4. He's also a columnist with the current newspapers. Last week you announced that you were going to be on vacation during the course of this week. Did that actually happen?
Yes, it did. I was off all week, and on Monday I did a silent retreat at my own home because it's a lot cheaper. No phone, no message, no email, no TV, no radio, nothing, just me in my apartment. Quiet for over 8 hours.
Did you actually practice some form of transcendental meditation?
No, I cleaned up my old tax records from the 1990s.
No, that's
but not saying a word and not talking to anyone. It's a remarkable experience. I kind of liked it. I felt like I'd been gone for 2 or 3 days.
Well, maybe that's what you should do whenever you have a vacation someplace. Instead of going someplace, just stay by yourself for a while.
Pretty good.
Might work out. Also joining us in studio is John Cook. He is a Fairfax County Board Supervisor. He's a Republican representing the Braddock District. Supervisor Cook, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Kojo. It's great to be here.
If you have questions or comments for John Cook, start calling now, 800-433-8850. You can send email to kojo@wamu.org. Shoot us a tweet at Kojo Show or go to our website, kojoshow.org. Watch the live video stream. Ask a question or comment there. Before we get into the specifics of Fairfax County, there was a poll taken and released yesterday by Christopher Newport University, indicating that if Donald Trump becomes the Republican candidate for president, as many as 29% of Republican voters in the Commonwealth of Virginia say they'd vote for somebody else or not vote at all. 13% say they would vote for Hillary Clinton. Another 13% say they would opt for a third-party candidate. And 3% say they would not vote at all. Tom Sherwood, I know this is something that interests you.
Well, you know, I think a lot of people may not be familiar with the Christopher Newport School, but
yes.
Quentin Kidd, who runs it down there. But it's a very well-respected school, and its research into Virginia politics is people pay attention to it.
Which is why Quentin Kidd has been frequently on this broadcast.
Right. And it all said, the flip side of that, of course, is that if people... that Hillary Clinton's voters or Bernie Sanders voters are far less dug in as to who they won't support. So it seems to me, and I would ask Mr. Cook this as a Republican, a suburban Republican, Virginia is a purple state. Florida, Virginia, Ohio are key states in the presidential campaign. I'm not even sure who you're supporting, but what do you make of the poll?
Well, you know, it's when you're talking about the general election, it's pretty early on talking about, you know, asking people to speculate what they would do if somebody was nominated in a few months, and then how would they feel in the fall. I think it is. So I'm not surprised by it. I think, you know, it's Donald Trump would have a difficult road if he were the nominee. But, you know, it's too early to tell. There's a lot that might happen between now and November.
Who did you support in Virginia?
Well, I am on Governor Kasich's team, and, you know, we'll see what happens.
He's the sleeper.
Well, he is, and, you know, I think there's a lot of primaries still to come, and I think the voters have the right to speak through their votes, and then it's a delegate process at a convention, and there will be some candidate will get a majority of delegates, and then under the rules of the convention, that candidate will win.
So a lot of people think Kasich is the one the Democrats should fear. He doesn't have all the negatives. He is a conservative, but he doesn't have all those negatives that Ted Cruz has or even Donald Trump. But there's a difficult path for him to get there.
I think you're right on all those points.
It's a difficult path for him to get there, but obviously, given what just happened in Wisconsin with Ted Cruz beating Donald Trump. It's now kind of up in the air as to what's going to happen, A, between now and the convention, and B, what's likely to happen at the convention itself. Inquiring minds want to know, what do you think will happen? You want to speculate?
I don't know what's going to happen.
Talk to your friend Corey Stewart in Prince William County. He's running the state campaign
for Donald Trump.
It certainly appears more and more likely that no candidate will go into the convention with a lock on a majority of delegates. And then I'm sure there'll be a debate on rules, as there usually is. This time, people will pay more attention to that debate.
Will you be a delegate?
I will not be a delegate, so I will be.
Were you last time for?
I was not. It'll be interesting to watch.
As we said, our guest is John Cook. He's a Fairfax County Board Supervisor. The county's financial health has been in the news with headlines like, "This model of wealthy suburban living is starting to fray." There are concerns about funding for the county's schools, parks, roads, and services. How did Fairfax get here?
Actually, I think Fairfax County is in very good shape. I think 95% of local governments across this country would love to be in the financial position that Fairfax County is in. The national economy has not been great for 8 years now. The Northern Virginia economy has been difficult because of the backing away of defense contracting money from the federal government. So our economy has to adjust. And like all local governments, we have had a bit of a revenue squeeze. And so we have made difficult but necessary choices in our budgeting. I think our county has done well working through those issues. And we've got to continue to work in a challenging financial environment.
Let me just follow up on that for a second, because there's been heated debate, much more heated than normal on the board, about how to address these issues. But ultimately this week, the board passed a new cap on property taxes, allowing for no more than an increase of 4 cents that would bring it up to $1.13 per $100 of assessed value. How will that help? Will some would say, fairly small increase address the shortfalls in the budget?
Well, we have to every year balance the impact of increased property tax rates with the desire for spending on programs.
Schools.
Schools being, of course, the biggest item in our budget. But we've done that balance every year, and we'll do it again. We cannot keep putting on our residential taxpayers the full burden of all spending. That has an especially disproportionate impact on senior citizens because our only real means of revenue is the property tax.
And so, there was a proposal to put it at 5 cents and another even less popular proposal to put the cap at 6 cents. But you raise senior citizens because they and others on a fixed income who live in the county, there are concerns they won't be able to afford to stay in the county if property taxes keep going up.
I think that's a valid concern. It's a concern that I have. I don't think that we can continue to have significant increases in the property tax rate. For the last 4 years, over the last term of the board, the rate went up 2 pennies in 4 years. And we came through 4 years of tight budgets in pretty good shape. So to be saying that somehow the advertisement at 4 cents does not provide enough, I don't agree with. I think that we will have a budget that will provide for needs, but we do have to have continued discussions, and the board has pledged to have that. We're going to look at new revenue sources. I have proposed that we ask the General Assembly for authority to tax cigarettes and alcohol at rates that our cities in Virginia can do. That would raise money for schools. Others on our board are advocating for meals tax, and our board's going to have that discussion this spring about what revenue sources we should seek.
Is there any indication that the General Assembly, which guards its power to say what you can do and can't do very strongly in the Virginia, any indication that they would go along with your proposal?
It certainly is a difficult road, but it hasn't been pushed. There's been a bill for the last 2 years for the cigarette tax that hasn't gotten out of committee in the House, but it hasn't been one that has been pushed in Northern Virginia, and I think it's time that we look at that. We do, as you pointed out, Tom, there's a lot of demand for school spending especially, and we have to all get on a page and say, well, where should we put our shoulders to the the wheel here and push. And I hope that's something that we're going to do to advocate for that authority for spending.
Steve Fuller, the economist from George Mason
right.
University, says that the area is growing, even as the infrastructure is aging, the federal government is shrinking. It seems to me that the county, even though it is in basically good shape, is being squeezed more than ever before since the growth of the suburbs 40, 50 years ago.
Well, certainly if you compare 15 years ago when we had a real estate bubble looking back, we now know was a bubble, and there was a lot of new spending. That was a different economic environment. But the key is you always have to be looking ahead. And so we have a new plan for economic success in Fairfax County that we passed this year. It's a forward-looking plan. And so instead of looking back 15 years and saying, oh, boy, wasn't it nice when real estate was rocketing and in a bubble, instead we're saying, where are we now? What's the county look like? What are the challenges? And what are the opportunities?
Are you getting the millennials? Arlington has one of the largest growth in millennials who don't want to live in the city itself are living in Arlington. Where are you getting the young people who will be able to afford the houses, be able to afford the cost of school?
We're going to, because if you drive through Tyson's or you drive through Reston, you're going to see a lot of buildings under construction. These are 24-story Class A, the best buildings you can buy, because business wants to locate in Fairfax County, and the millennial workers are going to want to live near where they work. They like to ride transit, and so we are, we're approving a lot of residential development in Tysons and Reston. Millennials will come, they will work and live in a transit-oriented, urbanized environment that's going to be exciting for millennials.
But this is the politics hour. How do you, as a Republican, and what would you call yourself, a moderate conservative Republican?
I try not to put labels on. I try to think
we
of myself.
We do. We love labels.
I know you do. But I serve everyone in my district and everyone in the county, and I like to think of myself as common sense.
You have a very broad-based activity. I looked at your website and other things you're doing. But the Republican Party, there's a crossroads. We talked about the presidential race, but the Republican Party is in danger of losing the millennials on social issues, on what government should or should not be. I just see the state party today. Jerry Kilgore, the former attorney general, has been named the finance chairman for the state Republican Party to get the party through this presidential year and get geared up for the gubernatorial race next year. Are you concerned at all that the campaign for president is going to sour young people, millennials, on the Republican Party?
Well, I think it depends where that campaign ends up. All I can say is I represent a district that voted about 58% for President Obama and then reelected me twice. And, I think I've set a course that Republicans ought to look at. I am fiscally conservative. I, support pro-growth economics. When I think in terms of making families stronger, so I've been an advocate against domestic violence. I've been an advocate against sexual assault.
I don't know anybody who's for domestic violence.
Right? No, but there's a lot of people who just turn an eye or don't give it the emphasis that it needs. Because in Fairfax County, when half of our homicides are based in domestic violence, it's something that we ought to be concerned about. We ought to want strong families.
And that's true in Prince George's County. A lot of people are saying, in Montgomery County too, a lot of things are driven by domestic violence.
Yeah, it's a big issue. It's an important issue. I've taken it on as one of my primary focuses.
Gentlemen, don your headphones, please, because we're about to go to the phones. We're Scott in Reston, Virginia awaits us. Scott, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Hi. I live in Reston, and I'm a small business owner. I've been in my company for about 10 years. And I'd also just like to say that I absolutely love the economy in Reston, and the company has been doing really well. But what I'm not really seeing so much with Fairfax County is a lot of more opportunities for small business to have public-private relationships and contracts. So it seems like a lot of other small businesses are really sort of more driven towards federal partnerships as opposed to with the county or the state. So I guess I'd like to hear what your thoughts are on being able to provide a strong network for small businesses to collaborate with the local government to help improve the county. And the county is phenomenal. I love Reston and Fairfax, and my kids are in Fairfax County School, so I'm dedicated to the community. But I would like to see
Here's John Cook.
You are absolutely correct. What a great question, because one important part of our economic success plan for Fairfax County is to emphasize small business. And I've been one of the people in the county advocating for those public-private partnerships that you're talking about. We've got a lot of opportunities in our county, in our school system, businesses that want to partner with local government to create economic growth, and that is critical. Small business is always the future of the economy, and it's absolutely an important part of the future of Fairfax County.
Are you talking about privatizing parts of the government and allowing private business to do it? Or what do you mean when you say public-private part? Give me an example of a good
PPP.
It can be a couple of different things. It can be contracting out for a service. It can be things like looking at a development project and saying, how can we perhaps have a place for government services that's part of a development that a developer is building, where we partner with them, and the developer is putting in money, the county's putting in money, and the end result is a complex that serves a number of different purposes. Having all sorts of things, looking at schools and libraries being together and co-located. And there's a lot of opportunities to work together on things. The business community is a great source of ideas, and we should be encouraging business to come forward, and they are coming forward and saying, let us work with you on various things.
Schools. School Superintendent Karen Garza says the county is putting the school system in jeopardy because of a funding shortfall totaling around $68 million. Will the school suffer in this current budget climate?
I have five children currently attending Fairfax County public schools and would never want
to
see.
That means one must have graduated.
That's right.
One's okay. Six children.
Yeah, one's a teacher down in Hampton, and she's doing great. We love our teachers. No, I think our school system, just like the county, is challenged, but is going to do very well. School enrollment now in Fairfax has leveled out. During the recession, we found people were not leaving Fairfax County. They were still coming in. School enrollment was going up by a couple thousand students a year, and that was causing causing some stretching. With enrollment now leveling off, with level enrollment, and we're talking about above 3% increases in the transfer to the school. So, sure, we need to work together, but we're going to continue to have a great school.
You may love your teachers, but when it comes to teacher salaries, it's my understanding that teachers can make an additional $15,000 a year simply by moving next door to Arlington. How do you address that, Kat?
Well, we have to put more money in the teacher pay, and that has to be done in two ways. One is the school board, which makes the school decisions about how to spend the money, has to give top priority to teacher pay instead of having it be farther down the line. And then we have to do our job and step up and find sources of revenue for the schools. If we were able to get cigarette tax, alcohol tax, or if we have a meals tax or one of these other revenue sources, we ought to commit that to teacher pay. A segment of that ought to be dedicated to teacher pay so that we can address that gap in teacher pay. Because you're right, over the course of a career, Fairfax teachers are falling behind, and we need to catch up, and we can do it.
Let's talk about just for 1 second to digress on the issue more broadly of books in schools. Governor McAuliffe vetoed legislation that would have banned, that would have allowed parents to decide whether or not to allow their children to read sexually explicit textbooks. It was nicknamed the Beloved Bill because the supporters have cited that work as a book that's too graphic for some students. Where do you come down on that issue?
I really don't. I got to tell you, I haven't read the book. Our board doesn't make curriculum decisions. That's the school board's job, and I'm not going to tell them what books they have in the school
system. But this state law would have allowed parents, all K through 12, to go to a school system and, first of all, be notified of any books assigned to their children, and then decide, well, I don't want that book. You have to let my kid read another book. It sounded like a 1950s thing to me.
Yeah, I'm really
book banning, book burning, book. It's just extraordinary. There's so many things you guys need to do.
Well, that's right. I mean, and that's why I really haven't spent any time looking at the issue. I haven't pulled up the book to read it because
the governor vetoed it.
That's right. So it's not an issue.
It's moot at this point.
Well, there you go.
Here now is Josh, who is in Fairfax. Josh, your turn.
Hey, thanks, Kojo. Love your show. We just heard that the schools have leveled out in Fairfax, which is great. But what are we doing to address the fact that they've leveled out at a high level? You know, my son's in 30, I think there's 35 kids in his fifth grade class in the Fairfax school system. I mean, it's with one teacher. You know, our kids are in mobile classrooms. They're stretched to capacity. And if they've leveled out at that level, that's great. But let's match the resources that they need to that level. I'm not seeing that happen in Fairfax.
But Josh, you know, you're absolutely right that we need to put more resources into our schools, and we're going to do that. We're going to have a meeting of our board later this spring to talk about new revenue sources, and then we're going to have a meeting, a joint meeting, a retreat with our school board to talk about how to spend those resources. And the first priority in my book has got to be teacher pay. But, yes, we have to continue to work on making sure that our school system stays a great school system. It's a great system now, and we can make it stay that way.
And the population of the school system is far more diverse now than it used to be.
Absolutely.
It's a characterization of that.
It's a different school system, and so, you know, the priorities of 20 years ago are not necessarily the things that we ought to be priorities now. For example, we know that career and technical education, very important, because somewhere around half of our Fairfax County graduates will not become graduates with a four-year college degree. So preparing them for the workforce, working with our industry to have career and technical education, very important. We have a greater percentage of special needs students.
Language disparities.
Languages. We need to teach English to students who don't speak English. So those need to be priorities in our school budget.
There was a time when, as a Fairfax County lawmaker, you would have free access to county parks, facilities, golf courses, swimming pools, fitness centers. But under the state's new ethics laws, no more. How do you and your colleagues feel about that?
That's fine.
they now make 95. Didn't this year you guys start making 95,000?
That's true.
It was a $20,000 raise. Do people gripe about that? Only when I bring it up.
Only when people like you bring it up. No, I mean, you know, look, I voted against it. I thought it was too big of a jump at the time we enacted it. But as you said on a previous question, that's passed now, and it is what it is. And, you know, it's an honor for me to serve on the Fairfax board.
Why don't you somebody move to Fairfax as opposed to Arlington?
Boy, how long is the show? I can give you a lot of reasons.
Give me the 20 seconds.
In a minute
answer.
Or less.
Right,
yes.
Because we're going to be the center of economic growth in the region. We already
manage
are.
Manage Tyson's Corner so there can be a human scale.
Tyson's is going to be a phenomenal place to live. We have new Diversion First program I'm very involved in, where we're going to have treatment instead of incarceration for people with mental illness who run into the legal system. Very forward-looking, a brand-new re-engineering of our police department, where we are going to be on the cutting edge of 21st-century policing.
So who are you going to support for governor next year?
You know, I
Ed Gillespie?
Probably Ed. Ed's a great guy, works very hard, very bright, and is committed to economic growth. And that economic growth is the key to everything we want to do.
It's Paul in Fairfax, Virginia. Paul, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Hey, Kojo. I'm a longtime Fairfax resident. Actually, I'm an employee of Fairfax as well. It's a pleasure to speak with you, by the way, after many years of listening.
Thank you.
I'm actually calling to speak with the supervisor there. I've actually worked for the county for almost 9 years now, and I've noticed every year we have the same argument over the real estate assessment rate, essentially paying for whatever increases in funding for various county agencies. But I'm seeing that come at the cost of basically everyone I work with, specifically on the public safety side, is starting to move farther and farther away from the county because they're finding it very difficult to afford housing in this area. I was wondering if there was any way they could address either employee compensation increases or affordable housing for people that don't obviously make in excess of $100,000 a year.
Right. Well, those are great questions and issues as well. You know, last year, 2 years ago, I was part of a subcommittee that put together a new compensation plan for our general county employees, and we're fully funding that plan this year. We have committed to the funding the public safety compensation plans as well, so you know there'll be a full MRA as well as your regular increases this year. We know that we've got a plan to go through all of the various categories of our employees over the next few years and make sure that we are competitive in the market on pay. So we're going to be doing that with public safety because that's so important. And yes, we have to continue to look at affordable housing. You know, I want to encourage the private sector to build as much housing as it can for good working people like yourself. And we in the county need to have policies to encourage the private sector to create that housing, because I want you and your colleagues to stay here living in the county and working in the county.
The final issue in Fairfax, parking enforcement, targeting cars awaiting state inspection for repairs. One of your colleagues introduced a bill that was signed into law this week by Governor McAuliffe prohibiting that practice. Was this a money-raising endeavor on the county's part or simply the work of overzealous ticket writers?
It certainly was not a money-raising activity, because we don't, in Fairfax, we do not use parking enforcement as a revenue measure. I will say that was not my district where that happened, and I understand from the former Sully supervisor, Mike Fry, my friend and colleague from last year when this story broke, that there were some details of that, as I understood it, to be sort of not necessarily a single incident, but certainly not a countywide incident. But no, we do not want people to have to pay any sort of fine when they're waiting to have their car fixed.
John Cook, he's a Fairfax County Board Supervisor. He's a Republican representing the Braddock District. Thank you very much for joining us.
Thanks for having me on the show.
Sounded way too moderate.
No, he didn't. He sounded just fine. Tom Sherwood is our resident analyst, and he's a reporter with NBC4 and a columnist with the Current newspapers. Coming up is Phil Mendelson. He is the chair of the D.C. City Council, or the chair of the D.C. Council. It's not a city council.
It is not the city council.
Thank you very much. It is a council. But before we get specifically to that conversation, this past Sunday, Ivanhoe Donaldson died, and there are a lot of people in this town who live in this town now who have no idea who Ivanhoe Donaldson was. So I'd like to start off with this report we had on Ivanhoe Donaldson on WAMU by Jacob Fenston.
He was Marion Barry's Olivia Pope, or Tom Hagen. Donaldson first met Barry in the early 1960s. They were both activists with the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, or SNCC. Here's Donaldson in an oral history interview with the University of Southern Mississippi.
SNCC became not only a place where social change was fermenting, you know, it became a university, and you were constantly talking about organizing and techniques of organizing.
Donaldson spent weeks in jail and had numerous brushes with death, including narrowly escaping a lynch mob in 1961. Cortland Cox is another civil rights veteran who met Donaldson during those years.
Okay, let me just see.
When I met Cox, he was trying to pull up a video on his phone.
Let me see.
It's the civil rights song, They're Falling All Around Me, a song that's been on his mind since Donaldson's death.
I mean, basically it's the passing of a generation of people who 50 years ago made tremendous changes in this country. They did it through the sit-ins, they did it through the Freedom Rides, they did it through the voter registration drives, they did it through political organizing in the cities.
His passing is another one of our soldiers who's gone on home, and I'm going to miss him.
Frank Smith is another former SNCC activist who met Donaldson in the 1960s. Years later, when Barry got involved in politics in D.C., Smith says Ivanhoe Donaldson was at Barry's side, running his campaign for mayor, then as a key player in the administration.
He was the guy that kept a list of people who supported him and a list of people who didn't. And you know, his job was to reward the people who were part of the team and punish the ones who weren't.
Ivanhoe Donaldson was one of the first in that generation of activists to see the importance of political power and to figure out how to win it. So why is it you've probably never heard of him? During the early 80s, Donaldson lived a lavish lifestyle with a taste for luxury cars and a habit of starting businesses that didn't pan out. The money to pay for it all was coming from a slush fund and city checks for phony contracts. In 1986, Donaldson was convicted of stealing $190,000 from the city. He spent 3 years in jail.
I don't dwell on that.
Cortland Cox says all the good Donaldson did more than balances out that one really big mistake.
When I look at it in a balanced view, he led a consequential life that everybody should be proud of.
Just 1 year after Donaldson was released from prison, Marion Barry was himself under arrest on cocaine charges. Harry Jaffe with The Washingtonian says Barry's career might have gone differently if Donaldson had stuck around. Donaldson was always the guy who could challenge Barry, the guy who, as Barry lost control, might have said,
"Yo, Marion, brother Barry, stop this craziness."
Ivanhoe Donaldson passed away on Sunday at the age of 74. I'm Jacob Fenston.
We're talking about Ivanhoe Donaldson with Tom Sherwood. He's our resident analyst. And joining us in studio is Phil Mendelson. He is chair of the D.C. Council. Phil Mendelson, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me. It's good to be here.
Did you know Ivanhoe Donaldson? How?
Yes, not well. I mean, I was elected to the council in 1998, and he left the government in 1983, but I did know him.
You used to work for Council Member David Clark at one
yes.
time, did you not?
And yes, in the 1990s.
Tom Sherwood, how did you know Ivanhoe Donaldson?
Well, I knew Ivanhoe because of his political wherewithal around Marion Barry. And Cortland Cox has it about right. It's unfortunate that you cannot, in a public life, say, okay, well, he did these bad things, he did more good things, so therefore he was a good person, the bad things don't matter. The bad things matter. The siphoning of money from public accounts matters because it does sully the reputation of someone who had worked very hard, who had been a Michigan State
student
and got involved in the civil rights struggle. And it's unfortunate we've kind of candy-coated the civil rights struggle now. People don't quite realize that lives were, in fact, in danger every moment during the civil rights struggle. And Ivanhoe was a soldier in that fight. And he came to town. Cora Masters Barry said it best about him and Marion Barry. She said that Ivanhoe called the plays and Marion ran the ball. And he was a strong person who helped bring African-American political, economic, and social power to a city that to this day is still largely run by white people. So he did a lot of great things. And that's why I get so angry when I think about the small potatoes corruption that he engaged in that ruined what otherwise could have been a much better situation.
Full disclosure here, Cortland Cox was one of my early mentors when I first came to Washington, D.C., and it was through him that I got to know Ivanhoe Donaldson. Later, as a reporter covering the city, I got to know him as the campaign manager for Marion Barry's first two campaigns, and in some of the positions that he occupied, I suspect that a lot of people believe that what Harry Jaffe said is true, that were he around, Marion may not have slipped into the kind of behavior that he slipped in, that he slipped into ultimately.
Well, I have to say, Barry was a strong personality. I'm not sure anyone would have stopped Barry from what he was doing.
But I also saw an interview that Ivanhoe did, I think it was in 2014, with Bruce Johnson from Channel 9, in which he made the point that Marion made Cortland Cox in charge of the Office of Minority Business, and in a lot of respects, Ivanhoe was the enforcer. He made the city's money that was being put, he took the city's money out of the treasury and put it into banks here and made a lot of those banks have African-American directors on their boards when they didn't before.
This is across the board. I don't care what business it was. But if you were a law firm, you want to do business, Marion Barry and Ivanhoe would say, well, where are your partners?
Exactly right.
And it, whatever business it was, so it was very important. Again, that's why it is so bad that he decided to take $4,000 here and $6,000 here and small amounts of money to undermine the very significant social, economic, political changes that he and Marion Barry brought, and that's why I'm kind of sad about that.
I have to
died.
Mention one other passing this week, Alma Brown, the wife of the late Commerce Secretary Ronald Brown and the mother of the former D.C. Council member Michael Brown. She was well known and highly respected in this town.
Can I just quickly say, Bruce Johnson over Channel 9, Channel 4, don't listen to this. If you go to the WUSA website, yeah. Bruce Johnson has 5 or 6 clips of a very nice interview that he did with Ivanhoe, I think after Marion Barry died, and you'll get a good sense of who he was.
Yep, that's exactly where I saw them myself. Our guest is Phil Mendelson. He's chair of the D.C. Council. If you have questions, comments, praise, denunciations for him, call us at 800-433-8850. You can send email to kojo@wamu.org. You can go to our website, kojoshow.org, watch the live video stream, participate in the conversation there, or shoot us a tweet at kojoshow. Council Chair Mendelson, the McMillan Reservoir site development, controversial to say the least. You introduced emergency legislation this week that the council approved to waive a competitive bidding requirement. Can you explain that move and why it was necessary, especially since you once opposed this project on preservation grounds and now you're guiding it forward? What's changed for you?
I think much more is being made of what the council did this week than is warranted by the substance of it. The facts are this, that the district back around 2007 picked a partnership team called Vision McMillan Partners, or VMP, to develop the site. And since then, there have been a number of actions reaffirming that decision that VMP would move forward, including in 2014, when now Mayor Bowser was chair of the council's Committee on Economic Development and moved three bills to dispose of the property to Vision McMillan Partners, or VMP. What's at issue here is that McMillan is a legacy project from the National Capital Revitalization Corporation, which was dissolved by Adrian Fenty in 2007 or 2008. And at the time, NCRC was exempt from the city's procurement laws. In other words, that the city could go forward after selecting VMP and make subsequent decisions on a sole source basis. VMP has been selected. They've been reaffirmed by numerous votes. As I mentioned, 2014 were three resolutions disposing of different parts of McMillan to VMP. But it turns out that when the council rewrote the Procurement Practices Act, the exemptions that the Deputy Mayor for Planning and Economic Development had inherited had, as a matter of technicality,
sounds
been
like
dropped.
Your vote for the council, because I know people get lost in the details, but it seems to me your emergency legislation just says move this project forward. We've had enough discussion about it. Let's clarify the legal entanglements and let's just go forward because we've had enough votes for it.
Auditor Kathy Patterson.
Yeah, that I was going to bring up. Kathy Patterson, former council member, D.C. auditor, has said this has been mishandled and that it should be rebid.
Didn't say that because I reread the letter coming over here
it's
today.
It's a serious matter to override reform and to spend taxpayer dollars without competition, and said there was a material change in this VMP role. And this VMP, let's be clear, this is Trammell Crowe, this is EYA, this is Jair Lynch. These are people.
For the viewers, let me just note that you're reading from your notes and not from the letter. The letter
this
notes.
I'm reading from Kathy Patterson's report.
Correct. The auditor sent a letter in the fall in which she noted that in around 2009, the role of VMP was expanded, that it went through a legal sufficiency analysis by the Attorney General and was deemed legally sufficient. She did not argue or contend that there was any illegality. What she did was she said the auditor's office has concerns that there was not competitive bidding. And
I don't think I said anybody illegality. It's just that the process been massaged in so many different ways. The sausage is particularly ugly in this case.
Her argument was that competitive bidding in real estate deals is the right way to go. And there was competitive bidding originally in 2007, and subsequently there was not competitive bidding. The expansion of VMP's role was done on a sole source basis. But she didn't say there was anything illegal.
And
the paragraph that you cite in her letter speaks to actions that occurred in 2009. The fact is that repeatedly, the government, and most recently the council by vote, has said that Vision McMillan Partners, VMP, is going to be the developer and proceed with this project. Now we're at a point where some contracts have to be issued for Vision McMillan Partner to do infrastructure work. Now, should those be competitively bid? That's kind of absurd. And in any event, the practice has been for years that McMillan, being a legacy project from the NCRC, the Tony Williams administration, was exempt from the competitive bidding
process.
So
there's no political favoritism in the McMillan project?
Not that I know of. And in any event, what has been before the council for the last couple of years is based on previous decisions and not anything new. So I would not say that there's been any political favoritism in the recent decisions.
Again, I don't want to bog down the listeners in this, but when the city changed its Procurement Practices Reform Act in 2010, and this project was not exempt from it. I don't understand why it has to be exempt. If the auditor, what good is the auditor? And she is, in fact, hired by the council. I think, did you nominate her?
I absolutely did, and okay. I'm proud of that nomination.
Kathy Patterson has a pretty good reputation, I think, in the city. And for her to say that there is a serious matter to override the Reform Act of 2010.
No, she didn't say that. Well, that's a misreading of her letter. Her letter doesn't even speak to that issue.
Maybe it was the original report. Maybe it was her original.
No, her letter says
I'm not talking about her letter, I'm talking about her report.
Oh, I'm aware of the letter she wrote last fall. I'm not aware of a subsequent report, Tom. I think much more is being done of this.
I have quotes around this. I had to read it somewhere. I didn't make it up.
As I said, the decision was made years ago to go with Vision McMillan Partner. And what I said the other day when this came up at a council hearing was that there are other sides to this issue, one of which is that when the government makes a decision to go forward with a project, for better or worse, and this actually gets at Kojo's point about what my views were on the development of McMillan Reservoir 6 years ago, I think it's important that the government stand by its decision. And what the opponents of McMillan would like, and one of them said this quite bluntly the other day, is they'd like to start over, have a new design competition, and to, you know, to have a completely different development. And, yes, that might be a better project, and it might have better amenities, and maybe not. But the fact is that a decision was made, and then it was reaffirmed, and then it was affirmed again.
And
the
millions
council
have been spent on this project.
And millions have been spent, but more than that, there ought to be certainty in the process. As I said the other day, the district often negotiates not a very good deal, and it comes before the council, and maybe we can make some changes. But once it's been approved, the government needs to stand by its commitments and obligations and not start over. And okay. It's very damaging to start over. So the McMillan project, for better or worse, has been approved and reapproved and approved again, and we're going forward with it. And that would be why I have been, why I put forth the legislation the other day, and why I believe it's important that the government continue with this project as it has already obligated itself to
do. On to another issue. The mayor's plan to close D.C. General and open smaller homeless shelters in each ward has come under fire from some residents as well as council members, you included, over the selection process and the cost to the city. We have Daniel, who's calling from Ward 3, who has a question on that. Put on your headphones, please, gentlemen, because Daniel is on the air. Go ahead, please.
Thank you, Kojo. I have a question for Chairman Mendelson about the shelter plan. So the mayor is in a design phase, it seems, of this shelter plan, but the whole plan has been called into question, the cost, the process, you know, the site selection, so which seems to be a total disconnect. How are you seeing the situation now? I mean, should the mayor go back and start all over again?
The mayor, you should know, is hiring an outside company to analyze the plan and the price tag on the plan.
To analyze her own plan.
Right, and that,
after the fact.
That's on a very tight timeline, but let's hear what the council chairman has to say.
Well, I want to step back in time a couple of months ago when the mayor announced the proposal. And at the time that she announced the proposal, there was widespread concern that the idea of closing D.C. General and replacing it with 7 shelters around the city would generate a lot of opposition. And so she presented this as a package. She was very careful to not present one ward before another, but all 7 sites at the same time, and to make the point that we've got to go forward with all of this. If we're going to close D.C. General, we have to replace roughly 280 units, and we can't be picking this apart. She's won that battle. If you think about it, and most people haven't, nobody now is talking about, oh, no, we can't have one in Ward 3 or we can't have one in Ward, pick another ward. We've got to go forward with all of it. The concern, which the caller touches on, is whether the economics of these particular deals is the best economics. Now, I don't agree that we should go back and start all over, but I do think that the council needs to be looking at whether the economics of these particular deals are good. The bottom line is this. We're going to spend hundreds of millions of dollars over 20, 25 years. They're all leases. And at the end of that time, we will have paid for building these buildings but not own them. In fact, the value that will have been enhanced in the property because of these buildings that we're paying for goes to the property owners. And we end up with nothing. And we don't even have the homeless units at the end of these lease terms. And I'm not sure that that's a good deal. And on top of that, there's some evidence that the price that we're paying through these leases is far in excess of what the value is. Now, some folks are defending this, saying that, you know, the need for homeless to provide homeless services is going to cost more, yes, and that providing replacement shelters is good, yes. But as I said to somebody earlier, you know, we can all agree that it's good if I have three meals a day. And but that doesn't necessarily mean that I should pay $500 for dinner tonight. Especially, you know, it's one thing if I have $500 at Ruth's Chris Steakhouse for dinner tonight, but what if it's $500 at McDonald's tonight for dinner? And that's really what the question is here, whether we're getting the best deal on these.
So politically, where does this stand? I think the mayor wanted this voted up or down without changing one site in one ward or changing another.
Correct.
When is the vote? Where do we stand on this?
Hoped that the vote would be this month. We're still doing some analysis of the financial analysis of the real estate deals.
Is that the budget office? Who is we?
The council, the committee, the whole staff, and the budget office.
And various council members.
There's pretty widespread disagreement about the proposed shelter in Ward 5. That has nothing to do with the economics of the deal, although there are questions about that. This is, you know, when you talk about environmental justice, the Ward 5 proposed site is, I think, the poster child of what you don't want in terms of environmental justice.
And residents in that ward have suggested several other sites.
Yes, they have. But let me just say, so everyone knows, it's located next to the railroad tracks.
Although it's got some distilleries near it, too. Those are great
businesses. And a strip club.
But just for the politics of this, so people understand, you don't think you'll have a vote in April because of the concerns about the cost. Now,
I think you're correct.
The mayor won a big political victory when the council pretty much agreed with her. We will disperse public housing. Homeless sheltering around the city. She won that battle.
Yeah, and the public
I think that's good.
The public is saying that too. Whether
but
they all mean
we
it
don't
sincerely,
know.
I don't know. But the public has said that as well.
And the mayor has said she'd like to have these all done and open by 2018, so that then you could close DC
General.
And
one of the questions,
it also happens to be the middle of the next mayoral election. But if you don't,
I won't mention that. But let me just say that I'm not even sure that her proposal would meet her own schedule. And we've asked for details of the schedule and have not yet received them.
So it doesn't.
But several of these sites, in fact, I think it's four out of the seven sites, require zoning approval, including variances. And there's every reason to believe that that will delay the process significantly.
Not only that, but there's a huge political issue over who's on the zoning commission, who's getting appointed. You're holding up.
Got to move on because we're running out of time.
Yeah, no, I don't think the appointments are an issue here because
frankly,
there's only
you only
one
have
pending.
About 3 minutes left.
Well, you should have had me on earlier.
We got an email from John in Adams Morgan, who says, Mayor Bowser says in her State of the District last month that she'd send minimum wage legislation to the council when it returns from recess. Well, the council came back this week. Has she sent legislation?
No, we've not received the minimum wage legislation.
And that's it's a big issue. Do you support the $15 by 2020?
I would like to see the minimum wage go up. But I think that, first of all, we haven't seen the details of what she's proposing. There's a question about how it gets phased in. And ideally, I'd like us to see the same approach that we did several years ago when we worked with our colleagues in Prince George's and Montgomery Council. Let's do this regionally, not just be an island within the region.
I want to be clear on this homeless thing. Politically, it's unclear now when the council will vote because of the issues about how the costs are structured and maybe the sites of one or two.
Sites in Ward 5, as Kojo noted, and if he would roll back the clock, we could get into that a little bit
I don't want to get into it, but the issue is the mayor's plan, as ambitious as it is now uncertain because of the cost.
And let me emphasize also that when you need variances from the zoning Board of Zoning Adjustment, that can take, that can delay this by a half a year or a year. I think her 2018 schedule is a bit optimistic, given her own choices.
How is your relationship with the mayor? Because, you know, you guys have had a tough time for a while. Have you gotten to where you'll talk to each other more?
We meet about weekly. We didn't meet this week because I had a hearing on the budget for several of our agencies.
But personally, you guys are getting around. She's very strong-willed. Now, I once asked her, you seem to want 100% of what you want. She said, I do, and so do you.
Yeah, well, you know, working with the legislature, you've got to be flexible.
Quite a bit in the news around marijuana and legalization. There was the White House protest organized by one Adam Eidinger and the response from the DEA, which said this week that it'll decide soon whether to change the federal status of marijuana to essentially reclassify it from a Schedule I drug. But earlier this week, you led a divided D.C. council to ban marijuana clubs. You are fully in agreement with Mayor Bowser on this. It's the second reversal on this issue in 4 months.
Oh, so I others, still don't agree.
Others argue that black residents are still disproportionately arrested and charged with smoking marijuana in public, and that's why many advocates say pot clubs are important. Now your response.
Well, first of all, the council didn't reverse anything. There have been 7 votes, which is a majority of the council, for not permitting these private clubs. Okay. The private clubs might make sense if we were able to regulate. But because of a congressional rider, the local government, the council is unable to regulate in this area. And in that context, not just me and Kenyon McDuffie, chair of judiciary, not just me and Kenyon and the mayor, but the three of us and the chief of police have all been on the same page here, that in the current context, we can't have these private clubs.
Because that would be a regulation?
Because we can't regulate around
it. The congressional mandate is that you cannot spend any city money to enforce marijuana. And so what we have is we can have it in our homes, but there's no enforcement or taxing or anything. David Grosso wants to tax it. You can't do anything about marijuana except to allow it in homes.
And, you know, that's what the referendum said.
Congress interfering with
those are the terms of the referendum, a possession of a small quantity by individuals is legal.
In your home.
And what really is being debated here is something that goes beyond that. It expands
that.
Got
a tweet from Adam who says, please ask Mendo when he'll move universal paid leave to a committee markup.
Well, I'm hopeful that we will get to it before the council recess. I know there are folks who are impatient, but this really is it's a complex issue economically.
Did New York just do 6 weeks?
They did, but I'm not sure it's at 100% reimbursement. I'm not sure exactly how many conditions qualify for it. And we want to do this right so that we have the best universal paid leave program in the country, that because we can't tax in non-resident employees, we can adequately fund this.
Phil Mendelson is chair of the D.C. Council. Thank you very much for joining us. That's it for the show this week. But remember, we've got lots going on off-air as well. Visit kojoshow.org/blog and check out sound from our tour of the Anacostia Community Museum exhibit, 12 Years That Shook and Shaped Washington, 1963 to 1975, and to read about local teens who are designing changes they want to see in D.C. neighborhoods through a program at the National Building Museum. Have a great weekend, but be sure to meet us back here Monday at noon when we'll consider a recent move Maryland's Republican governor has made, appealing to President Obama for help tackling gerrymandering in the old state. Plus, we go inside an experimental new international high school with a holistic approach to keeping kids in school as it caps off its first year.